This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Nathaniel Tarn was born in 1928 in Paris, France, educated at Cambridge, Yale, Chicago, the London School of Economics, and the London School of Oriental and African Studies. In anthropology, he worked mainly in Highland Guatemala and Burma, eventually teaching for 7 years at the School of Oriental and African Studies, part of the University of London. He's an internationally respected poet, translator, critic, editor, and anthropologist. His poetry was praised by Octavio Paz for its rich temperament, a remarkable linguistic inventiveness, and a vision both original and universal. He's a pioneering translator of Pablo Neruda and has published more than 20 books of poetry, essays, and translations. Tarn was in the San Francisco Bay Area on October 27, 2008, when I asked him to read from his latest book of poems, Ins and Outs of the Forest Rivers, published by New Directions. Let's go now to Nathaniel Tarn. Before we turn to your new book, Ins and Outs of the Forest Rivers, you have been around for a while now, some 80 years, correct? And as someone I suspect has always been deeply engaged with the world through the arts, archaeology, ecology, various culture, God knows enough wars to choke a horse. How has all of this informed your poetry, which really proves you to be a very thoughtful person?
There's almost nothing in which I'm not interested. So that causes terrible problems, a great deal of anxiety. My library holds probably in the 20 to 25,000 books, and I'm now 80, as you pointed out, and, you know, when do I have time to read all this stuff?
Well, your work includes political poetry, love poems, philosophy, science, all kinds of things, and I think that's just one of the reasons why it is so interesting. You bring all of these different interests into your work. So, I don't know, maybe you just need another 80 years so you can keep reading.
Well, I often say, you know, I talk about my third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh retirement. I talk about I need another 200 years on this particular subject, et cetera.
Yeah, good for you. Well, you've written in many different styles, from more compressed poems like Seeing America First, your book Seeing America First, where the poems are all perfectly rectangular, to your more free-flowing Whitman-esque type of poems. And your work also fluctuates quite a bit between the more complex, obscure work to the far less obscure work. And I'm wondering if you have done this intentionally to reach all kinds of audiences.
I do believe that there are different kinds of audiences out there. You know, the general reader, many poets nowadays, because they're so aware of the fact that the main readership for poets is other poets at this point, they say, oh, well, the general reader's nonsense. I persist in thinking that the general reader exists all the way over to, indeed, the audience of poets. And so, you know, on the general reader's side, you have to keep things reasonably simple. Reasonably, I mean, you can expect some hard work, but, you know, the whole thing should be, as I say, junctive. In other words, one thing follows one thing to another. And then in the field of poets, the problem there is that as the art advances in a progressive tradition, we seem to be going more and more and more towards the disjunctive. And that requires a kind of understanding on the part of the reader, which the, quote, general reader, unquote, you know, is usually unable, unwilling, too impatient to give.
Well, let's do turn to the ins and outs of Forest Rivers. I want to point out the structure of this book for people who cannot see it. The book opens with a poem dedicated to the poet John Olson, and then continues with five sections that I hope we'll have enough time to dip into in the program tonight. These sections are Of the Perfected Angels, which is a meditation on the Isenheim altarpiece, Dying Trees, which explores the deforestation of the American West, War Stills, which
in your lifetime could be about any number of wars, but it focuses on Iraq. Movement north of the Java Sea, which comes from your experience in Borneo, where you saw the loss of forest lands and the effect that that has had on tribal peoples. And finally, Sarawak, which is a single poem in which your guide and colleague dies of a heart attack at the furthest point in your tour of Sarawak, Borneo, East Malaysia. So the collection is very, very full, to say the least. Let's start with the first section and maybe read One Among Rose Gardens, which is one of the three Globo gardening poems.
Okay, these are three fairly lighthearted poems, although the next two, Hummingbird Sandwich and The Post-Eternal Rabbit, are more amusing than this one. This is actually about growing roses, which is very, very difficult in the little piece of New Mexico which I live in. Despite determinations of the landscape, soils, poverty, absence of shade, harassments of the blinding sun, I have persisted here toward my pride's fulfillment in a rose garden. This grace sits on the land, jewels at neck, wrists, ankles of a tan princess. Pinyons and junipers, oaks, pale mahogany, green of a robe, the only one she'll fancy throughout history. History here is almost, as it were, eternity, though we know not, under our single time to do and love. After more work this year than any previous, rewards have been beneficent. Blooms have erupted suddenly and almost altogether. They have their seasons as the local plants, dependent on shared weathers, the unity of all variables. The major difference, though, roses, maidenly-like bud mornings, by evening they have blown out of all proportion. After very few days, not more than a lean week, the desert tan prevails again. I have had one rare chance at a glass of buds on death. No more than four, where joy surprised in prehistoric days was weeks of death. It's what I love, what I have always done, what has sustained my life, sustains love still. Flowers' perfections, more than the birds, which moves, whistles, can often speak, is hope. Its most elementary statement ever. Far back recalled, it is the pity flower I insisted on in any visit, small humanoid, inspecting gardens like an emperor's gardener in whatever lieu we traveled. Reminds me, other dilemmas, decorations, laborsome situations, time's throaty laughter, tragedy's ransom. Outside, dead wars grind on into the barren sunset, all wars now, crying heaven's roses in globalizing deserts.
The second section of the book, The Dying Trees, really strikes home with me, and it does with many of your readers, because it's something we're witnessing on a daily basis. Would you please read from The Dying Trees?
Okay, this is a set of nine poems. This is number three. A drought from the declining of the planet, clogged from polluted and depleted breath, falling behind the shadow of a failing sun, a sun flaring in a great rage against this end, weakens the place's trees. Ghost beetles, smelling the dying from 2 miles away, rush to the place, Halloween gone mad, devour their way quite audibly from the trees. Landscape's mouth, great smile full of live teeth, ages in a few days, the teeth turn brown. Within a few more weeks, trees will shed needles, then remain black, hector-shaped growths on the land's health. How many years we give mankind from all this folly to come to bear survival, then fall, then disappearance from the scene complete, so that the earth alone survives and remains safe? All now seems fighting, but time and little else against cosmic collapse. Mother Juniper waves with her many yellow hands, her hands tipped off by moths, endless farewell to Father Pinyon as if ghosts turn. Do you remember monks burning among the trees that many years ago? No, you've forgotten them. And so much else? 7 cool million tons of bombs, thousands of prisoners tortured, burned, maimed, 500 guiltless murdered in a ditch. Among the pain recorded, how much not? Defoliation, that especially, the dying trees around the dying monks? Within this scheme, for nothing leaks from, quote, everything exists in the beginning, unquote. A devastated head, beauty devoured by age, needles of grief worn deep into the skin, small rivulets of patience also running down cheeks into the chin and neck, the mirror image of the face that's watching it across the room, a face broken on the same wheel, a marriage wheel of fortune, though all's been positive to date, even the grief. Time passes and will not be seized in any way, will not allow itself to be held down by its frail shoulders, arrested, stopped there in its tracks to be enjoyed. It must, like all else, be seized against the wind, caught on the wind, eternity, some said. Yet still, from time to time, the smile may flash, the smile still dazzles, and whole lives light up, as if illuminated by a tender fire, a burning, not destructive of our wood, but granting life, quick, urgent life, inclusive patience, and refreshing love.
In the third section of your book, War Stills, the poems are in groups. And I was hoping you would read La Città Morta, which has an epigraph by Paul Celan.
Word from Paul Celan I put in there partly because part of my family was Romanian, and also partly because, you know, people, when they see the word Celan, they think of German. But Paul actually wrote in Romanian before he wrote in German, mm-hmm. his young stuff. Mm-hmm. So this is. The city lies under the waters, the city lying under the sea, if it comes to that, one way or the other. Innumerable dead floating on the waters, countless houses and debris of houses floating on the waters. No one has sent anything for help. Pain, absolute solitude. All else, communal, dies, or walks out of the city never to home again. Sea, urban street lies in the green zone, and the bombs with men strapped to them explode under the waters. Men's fashions sway on by, women's sway on by, lashings of cleavage plunging the eternal opium of cleavage. In submarine sport, nation A defeats nation B, which defeats nation C, und so weiter. The fans swim up and down, howling and gnashing teeth. Books are produced, music produced, art is produced, and all of it is duly performed. Underwater, the drowned enjoy all these productions. A very few, sitting on house roofs above Mother Sea, enjoy all these productions. The leadership's collective testicles will fry in oil under the detestation of plebs deprived of voting machines. Ave Maria's sung in all the churches as an antidote to cleavage. The sad drowned are the only poor left in the land, since all the other poor have been sent for a soldier. Suddenly, the nation is cleaned of its disadvantaged, everyone is rich, and thanks go up among these rich. Thanks go up to the leaders now rematched in time for future elections. They'll go back once again, and go back once again, and go back once again, and again, and again, to the white father of cities at the inland heart, until the sea behaves and shivers back to its homeland.
Okay, we're going to move on to the fourth section of the book, Movement North of the Java Sea. And I was really stunned by your poem, The Island Weavers. Would you like to say anything about that poem before reading it?
Well, it's a parable. It's about what poets do and don't do and what they're looking for. That there should be islands, specified by the ocean, which needs a place to rest its waves. In the great deep, you understand, not neighbors to familiar coasts. The islands should be green, not common green, but devastating. with green that, seen at sea, takes out the eyes of sailors and blinds them to all colors, each made up of a vastitude of trees, Edenic garden, but pyramid from the Periplukos view, as if there were a central trunk and the whole island was single tree at heart. Tree's base, cave, and in the cave a weaver. All have the divine right to that. If not divine, then human should be. As travelers swirl round, they deem any one of these islands, the one detected and approached, is a home once owned for aeons. For not one of these travelers totals a human, there is some wariness. What they have harbored dreams of for so long is that this should be truth of any traveling, that any island whatsoever reach, including those they journey onto later, should feature a same tree, that cave, that weaver. Where they arrive, and at that place alone, a host of strangers gathers in the entrance and pleads daily and nightly with the weaver. By definition, though, by protocol, she will refuse. She does not still await a Homer. She has long lost all interest in that. It's only that she knows every lone roamer has this dream, not that he will be known, but that he's recognized and taken by the spirit of the place, and that the spirit bears the place's name and is his addict for that place. These hierogamies were structured long ago, struck to the very texture of all things and of the total song of things. There's no deletion possible. While the oncomer takes unlikely childish pleasure in the birds' colors on the many trees, the weavers sing a music which he has never heard before. Yet he suspects he is familiar with that music and with the air foaming above the pyramid, floating the bird. Feel free to switch the he into a she. Some men weave too from time to time among perilous.
We have one more section in the book, and that is Sarawak. And it's a long poem, and we don't have time for the whole poem. But maybe you would preface the poem by just telling us a little of the history here, her personal history, and then read a short segment from the poem.
You know, years and years and years back in anthropology, I was a mainland Southeast Asia man. And if I had realized that I could just do my job in mainland Southeast Asia and then switch to island Southeast Asia, maybe I would never have stopped being an anthropologist. Yeah. Island Southeast Asia is a miracle, and Borneo I have always been tempted by. And I found out that here in Berkeley, this is, of course, some years ago, there is a wonderful little NGO called Berkeley Project, the Borneo Project, which you can find on the web. And they do all sorts of wonderful work in Borneo. There are opportunities to volunteer, and I volunteered to go with one of their Dayak, the people are called Dayak there, one of their Dayak experts, on an 18-day trip, which would have been, you know, it was a lifetime opportunity. But anyway, to meet all sorts of people, and even the tribal people who are still, who still walk around. And the tragedy of the thing was that on the fourth night, we were lying on the floor of the headman's house, sleeping, and in the morning, to cut a long story short, my colleague dead. That scene, his death, is embedded in the poem. But the poem is also about the Borneo. Now, this last part refers to the great cloths. The Dayak were headhunters, and the women used to, it's an extremely complicated matter, but the women used to weave these magnificent pua cloths And they were receptacles for the heads, and but of course they have an enormous amount of. At the back of all buildings in the cities, mocking parameters of progress, forest walls rise in abundance, and from the walls hang the great war cloths along the whose strands the race depends. All beings once woven into the cloths, all beings compete there for air to breathe and food with which to tempt their hunger. The early patterns are the most complex, with the hooks on which creation hangs. All hangs together in a famous peace between the warring tribes of the great currents, set many years before in a red dye bath, back when an emperor lost out at Waterloo. This archaic image of the golden birth, which the tribe looks back to as its hair tears from the hooks, holding the heads in place, enemy heads ferociously parted from neighbor bodies, together with its own vivid catastrophe. But heads are not taken anymore, only the honors won by suffocating those who are too poor to eat their forest any longer, die in the ghastly city's imbecile job. The stench of sewers open for all to smell and drop into with both feet clawing as they fall from the great cloths of their lives. Conjunction of forest and sea, dark crimson dragonfly linking the two, stitching together landscape of the mind where we have seen before, head above clouds, landscapes remembered from another life, remembered by each other. Too much diversity hiding the forest's own behind a mask of sameness. I won't say previous, would rather claim some simultaneous lives running parallel with trigger hairs from time to time between them. Steadfastly birds refuse to manifest. They fly the gardens far below this perch. I climb this mountain by mistake on a bitch trail. No matter, for my mind is so replete with birds, so fabulous a kingdom of the upper sky cannot be abdicated for a bunch of facts, a bunch of species ticked off in a book. I am content behind these empty eyes. The dragonfly has left for the far mountain, the beach's other shore. I shall go down as well. My time goes down, the joyous sky and drinks drink up each other. I am as thirsty at this water as if this were my desert. The sun forgets the second star. What if this butterfly is the color of sky and night, and this one of the sea and night, and this one in the sun's blaze at midnight on the alternate side of world, night being the high color of wing and day being the low? I should have been a butterfly watcher, for they are out in the open with their delicate touches of paint in the midst of horror, whereas the birds now, the birds, alas. Butterflies are more direct, with their shorter spans more patient, read out to me in wavering lines, brief life and its annihilation. Whereas the birds move on and on, pierce the sky like arrows, never seem to fall. Their death is a quiet one in the deep forest, as the death of the forest is not quiet, the towering trees fall over and over. One dusk, as the light went down over the river, the one bird I had dreamed of seeing and despaired of ever seeing as the days went by, finally Lord Buceros himself, prince of forest and sky, bird of the river gods and gods of fallen heads, dropped out of the sky and covered a tree and seemed as large as the tree, covering it entirely. It was still possible to glimpse the colors of the head and know it for itself. Although this bright darkness preceded the death, a death mourned by its fellows, warrior bird was known to me, death redeemed. Lemba, Sungai, Kinabatangan, Saba, Miri, Mulu, Batangbaram, Sungai, Pelutan, Sibu, Kapit, Kaiwong, Palawong, Batang, Rajang, Kuching, Kuba, Bako, Sungai, Santubong, Sungai, Sarawak, 2005.
Now, you just listed, are these all places
that you traveled through
on this island?
You're listening to Word Temple with Catherine Hastings here on KRCB-FM. Be sure to stay tuned for Allegra Broughton, who will be here with Connections at 8:30 p.m. tonight here on KRCB-FM. And now back to Catherine Hastings and Word Temple.
You just heard Nathaniel Tarn reading from Ins and Outs of the Forest Rivers. Up next, Jane Hirschfield will give us a reading from her Northern California home. But first, here is Thomas Dutronc, and please do forgive my French, singing Je suis pas d'ici.
Un coup dans l'aile, le vent est doux, la lune fidèle, un chant de cigale, je me sens zigane, le cœur léger. Je vois passer une fleur d'été, hello jolie, je suis pas d'ici, je suis musicien, un soir je suis le roi, un soir le chien, qu'on caresse ou qu'on laisse en solo. On se dit tout, mais tout en fait c'est rien du tout. J'aime tes silences, tes rêves immenses. C'est l'heure de jouer, sous les étoiles j'ai pris ta main. Le monde est flou, jusqu'à demain. Je me jette à l'eau, faut bien que je prenne la vie comme un cadeau. Une caresse, une ivresse, un solo. Des fois je ne suis pas un cadeau. Une caresse, une ivresse, un solo. Un air de fête, une tempête de liberté. Un mojito, je vais me coucher tard. Deux mojitos, je vais me coucher tôt.
This is Catherine Hastings and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Jane Hirschfield was born in New York City and received her bachelor's degree from Princeton University in the school's first graduating class that included women. She's the author of 6 collections of poetry, including After, which was shortlisted for England's T.S. Eliot Prize, nominated for the Northern California Book Award in Poetry, and also chosen as one of the best books in 2006 by The Washington Post. Her other books of poems include Given Sugar, Given Salt, The Lives of the Heart, and The October Palace, as well as others. She also is the author of a book of essays, 9 Gates, Entering the Mind of Poetry. Recently, Jane Hirschfield invited me into her Northern California home to record a reading. Let's go now to Jane Hirschfield.
So even though this program isn't going to air for a little while, we're taping it fairly immediately after the election. And so I thought I would begin with a few poems about change, starting with one called Optimism. More and more I have come to admire resilience. Not the simple resistance of a pillow whose foam returns over and over to the same shape, but the sinuous tenacity of a tree. Finding the light newly blocked on one side, it turns in another. A blind intelligence, true, but out of such persistence arose turtles, rivers, mitochondria, figs, all this resinous, unretractable earth. So we can think of that as the natural world's confirmation of the, we can now happily say, inevitability of President Barack Obama. So I'm going to be reading poems that I don't necessarily often read, including a bunch of new ones are seeded throughout what I've picked out, and this is one of them. A thought. Some thoughts throw off a backward heat, as walls might at night in summer. It could happen this moment. Some movement. One word's almost imperceptible shiver. And what was long cold in your left palm, long cold in your right palm, might find itself malleable, warmer. An apricot could be planted in such a corner. And the last poem about change is very, very short. Mountain and Mouse. Both move, one only more slowly. I like very short poems. The Decision. There is a moment before a shape hardens, a color sets, before the fixative or heat of kiln. The letter might still be taken from the mailbox. The hand held back by the elbow, the word kept between the larynx pulse and the amplifying drum skin of the room's air. The thorax of an ant is not as narrow. The green coat on old copper weighs more. Yet something slips through it, looks around, sets out in the new direction for other lands. Not into exile, not into hope, simply changed. As a sandy track rut changes when called a silk road. It cannot be after turned back from. For any of you grammarians out there, I apologize for ending on a preposition. The poem simply wanted to do it. Green striped melons. They lie under stars in a field. They lie under rain in a field, under sun. Some people are like this as well, like a painting hidden beneath another painting. An unexpected weight, the sign of their ripeness. I have a number of cats in the neighborhood, all of whom like my garden very much. It's a large semi-wild garden. And for a while there were three of them, and this poem is what came out of that. Narrowness. Day after day, my neighbor's cats in the garden, each in a distant spot, like wary planets. One brindled gray, one black and white, one orange. They remind of the feelings, how one cannot know another completely, the way two cats cannot sleep in one patch of mint-scented shade. This is an older poem. One of the themes which has pervaded my work for many years is poems that come out of trying to get through very difficult times. And I've come to think of that group of poems or that type of poems as a kind of cookbook in which if one recipe doesn't work, you can just pick it up and try another. And this is one of the first of those poems which I wrote about a time which William Churchill described such periods as taking a long walk with the black dog. The Weighing. The heart's reasons seen clearly. Even the hardest will carry its whip marks and sadness and must be forgiven. As the drought-starved eland forgives the drought-starved lion who finally takes her, enters willingly then the life she cannot refuse, and is lion, is fed, and does not remember the other. So few grains of happiness measured against all the dark, and still the scales balance. The world asks of us only the strength we have, and we give it. Then it asks more, and we give it. I'm not sure this is the best poem to read aloud, but I want to do it anyhow. It comes from visiting the superb Bay Area poet Leonard Nathan when he was far into Alzheimer's in the respite place where he spent the last months of his life. So it's a difficult poem for me. But he was remarkable in that, like a different poem, which I'm not going to read, talks about him with the image of a fine oriental carpet, which some parts of it are vanished, eaten by moths, but the parts which remain are, of course, perfect. And his mind was like that. His intelligence and his vocabulary were like bedrock in him. The pear. November. One pear sways on the tree, past leaves, past reason. In the nursing home, my friend has fallen. Chased, he said, from the freckled woods by angry Thoreau, Coleridge, and Beaumarchais. Delusion, too, it seems, can be well read. He is courteous, well-spoken even in dread. The old fineness in him hangs on for dear life. My mind now, he says. A small ship under the wake of a large. They force you to walk on your heels here. The angles matter. 4 or 5 degrees, and you're lost. Life is dear to him yet. Though he believes it his own fault, he grieves. His own fault, his old friends have turned against him, like crows against an injured of their kind. There is no kindness here, no flint of mercy. Descend, descend, some voice must urge inside the pear stem. The argument goes on, he cannot outrun it. Dawnlight to dawnlight I look, it is still there. Chapel. The moonlight builds its cold chapel again out of piecemeal darkness. You who have ears and hands, it says, come in. No need to stamp the snow weight from your shoes. It lifts another block and begins to chisel. Kyoto, Vladivostok, Chicago, Beijing, Perth. Huge-handed, working around you in silence, as a cat will enter the silence where no dog lives. A day is fast. A day is fast until noon. Then it's over. Yesterday's pond water braided, still wet in my hair. I don't know what time is. You can't ever find it, but you can lose it. This is another one of those recipes for getting through difficult times, and it is also literally a recipe. Someone, after I'd read this poem, came up to me and said that he'd tried to make the soup and that it hadn't turned out well, which surprised me because I think the directions are very clear. But if any of you end up liking the sound of this soup, you can find it in the First Greens cookbook. And I came by it honestly because I was a cook at Greens Restaurant for its first 3 years of serving dinners. And the title is an Italian phrase from music, da capo. It appears at the end of a piece of music and is the instruction to play it again from the start. Da capo. Take the used-up heart like a pebble and throw it far out. Soon there is nothing left. Soon the last ripple exhausts itself in the weeds. Returning home. Slice carrots, onions, celery. Glaze them in oil before adding the lentils, water, and herbs. Then the roasted chestnuts, a little pepper, the salt. Finish with goat cheese and parsley. Eat. You may do this, I tell you. it is permitted. Begin again the story of your life. There is a surprising amount of food ingredients imagery in my work, something I only realized when I was asked to submit some poems for an anthology of food poems, and I suddenly went, oh my goodness, I do have a lot of those, but they aren't all necessarily edible, as the last one was. Vinegar and oil. Wrong solitude vinegars the soul, right solitude oils it. How fragile we are between the few good moments. Coming and going unfinished, puzzled by fate, like the half-carved relief of a fallen donkey above a church door in Finland. Yield and abandon. A muscular, thick-pelted woodchuck, created in yield and abandon, lifts onto his haunches. Abundance of ferns, a piled rock wall, a few noisy grackles. The rock's undeclarable silence, never in sun. Our eyes find shining beautiful because it reminds us of water. To say this does not make fewer the rooms of the house or lessen its zinc-ceilinged hallways. There is something that waits inside us, a nearness that fissures, that fishes. Leaf shine and stone shine, edging the tail of the woodchuck silver, splashing the legs of chickens and clouds. In Russian, the translator told me, there is no word for thirsty. A sentence, as always, impossible to translate. But what is the point of preserving the bell if to do so it must be filled with concrete or wax? A body prepared for travel, but not for singing. I find that quite remarkable that there's no word for thirsty in Russian, but it's apparently true. There's a word for hungry, but you have to use a phrase for thirsty. The envoy. One day in that room, a small rat. 2 days later, a snake, who, seeing me enter, whipped the long stripe of his body under the bed, then curled like a docile house pet. I don't know how either came or left. Later, the flashlight found nothing. For a year I watched as something, terror, happiness, grief, entered and then left my body, not knowing how it came in, not knowing how it went out. It hung where words could not reach it. It slept where light could not go. Its scent was neither snake nor rat, neither sensualist nor ascetic. There are openings in our lives of which we know nothing. Through them, the belled herds travel at will, long-legged and thirsty, covered with foreign dust. Now, I didn't actually realize it when I ordered this reading, but this is the poem the Russian translator was working on when I found out there's no word for thirsty. She was talking to me about the last line of the poem, long-legged and thirsty, covered with foreign dust. And first she emailed me about long-legged, and she said, long-legged. Now, in Russia, that's a kind of symbol for Americans. You didn't mean that, did you? And I emailed back and said, no, I actually didn't know. And she said, well, may I say spindly-legged instead? And I emailed back and said, well, you know, if it sounds good, sure. And then the next email came, and it was thirsty. She said, well, we don't have a word for thirsty. So could it be all right if it's spindly-legged, sides drawn in with thirst? And I emailed back and said, does it sound good? She said, yes. And I said, oh, sure, sure. And then the third email came from this apparently very simple line in which she said, now, foreign, do you mean far away or barbarian invader? So I chose far away rather than barbarian invader. And this is the kind of thing which really lets you understand the translation is indeed impossible. And yet somehow we all love translated poems. Go figure. A cedary fragrance. Even now, decades after, I wash my face with cold water. Not for discipline, nor memory, nor the icy awakening slap, but to practice choosing to make the unwanted wanted. Burlap sack. A person is full of sorrow the way a burlap sack is full of stones or sand. We say, hand me the sack, but we get the weight. Heavier if left out in the rain. To think that the sand or stones are the self is an error. To think that grief is the self is an error. Self carries grief as a pack mule carries the side bags, being careful between the trees to leave extra room. The mule is not the load of ropes and nails and axes. The self is not the miner, nor builder, nor driver. What would it be to take the bride and leave behind the heavy dowry? To let the thin-ribbed mule browse in tall grasses, its long ears waggling like the tails of two happy dogs. I was going to put this poem into the bottom drawer and thank it and bid it goodbye. And I gave it once at a reading, and the editor of a wonderful small local magazine, Runes, was at the reading and asked me if she could publish it. And I said, oh, you like it? Of course. And about 9 or 10 months later, it was picked by Paul Muldoon for Best American Poetry, which I guess is a story which proves only that I don't know which of my poems anyone else is likely to like. It's a little sobering that happens more than one would think. This poem is called Vilnius, and for anyone who doesn't recognize that word, it's sometimes also called Wilno. It's the name of the capital city of Lithuania. For a long time, I keep the guidebooks out on the table. In the morning, drinking coffee, I see the spines. St. Petersburg, Vilnius, Vienna. Choices pondered, but not finally taken. Behind them, sometimes behind thick fog, the mountain. If you lived higher up on the mountain, I find myself thinking, what you would see is more of everything else, but not the mountain. Habit. The shoes put on each time, left first, then right. The morning potion's teaspoon of sweetness stirred always for 7 circlings, no fewer, no more, into the cracked blue cup. Touching the pocket for wallet, for keys, before closing the door. How did we come to believe these small rituals promise? That we are today the selves we yesterday knew, tomorrow will be. How intimate and unthinking, the way the toothbrush is shaken dry after use, the part we wash first in the bath. Which habits we learned from others and which are ours alone, we may never know. Unbearable to acknowledge how much they are themselves our fated life. Open the traveling suitcase. There, the beloved red sweater, bright tangle of necklace, earrings of amber, each confirming, I chose these, I. But habit is different. It chooses. and we its good horse, opening our mouths at even the sight of the bit. This is another poem which has an ungrammatical word in it. There's a nor near the end, which isn't correct, but for some reason the poem absolutely demanded it, and much to my surprise, this is going to run in the New Yorker, and even their copy editor allowed it after a little conversation. French horn. For a few days only, the plum tree outside the window shoulders perfection. No matter the plums will be small, eaten only by squirrels and jays. I feast on one thing, they on another, the shoaling bees on a third. What in this unpleated world isn't someone's seduction? The boy playing his intricate horn in Mahler's fifth, in the gaps between playing, turns it and turns it, dismantles a section, shakes from it the condensation of human passage. He is perhaps 20. Later he takes his four bows, his face deepening red, while a girl holds a viola's spruce wood and maple in one half-opened hand and looks at him hard. Let others clap. These two, their ears still ringing, hear nothing. Not the shouts of bravo, bravo, not the tympanic clamor inside their bodies. As the plums blossoms do not hear the bee, nor taste themselves turned into storable honey by that sumptuous disturbance. Perishable, it said on the plastic container. Perishable, it said on the plastic container, and below, in different ink, the date to be used by, the last teaspoon consumed. I found myself looking, now at the back of each hand, now inside the knees, now turning over each foot to look at the sole, then at the leaves of the young tomato plants, then at the arguing jays. Under the table and lifted stones, looking. Coffee cups, olives, cheeses, sorrows, anger, fears. All around me my old companions, suspended and weightless. These two would certainly vanish without knowing when. How suddenly then the strange happiness took me, like a man with strong hands and strong mouth. Inside that hour, with its perishing perfumes and clashings. Okay, one really strange one, and then one more. The egg had frozen, an accident. I thought of my life. The egg had frozen, an accident. I thought of my life. I heated the butter anyhow, the shell peeled easily, inside it looked both translucent and boiled. I moved it around in the pan. It melted, the whites first clearing to liquid, then turning solid and white again like good laundry. The yolk kept its yolk shape. Not fried, not scrambled. In the end it was cooked. With pepper and salt, I ate it. My life that resembled it, ate it. It tasted like any other wrecked thing, eggish and tender, a banquet. And I will close with this, a poem which was written at the end of a period in which many, many people whom I cared a great deal about died in close proximity. It was like this. You were happy. It was like this. You were happy, then you were sad, then happy again, then not. It went on. You were innocent or you were guilty. Actions were taken or not. At times you spoke. At other times you were silent. Mostly, it seems, you were silent. What could you say? Now it is almost over. Like a lover, your life bends down and kisses your life. It does this not in forgiveness. Between you, there is nothing to forgive, but with the simple nod of a baker at the moment he sees the bread is finished with transformation. Eating too is a thing now only for others. It doesn't matter what they will make of you or your days. They will be wrong. They will miss the wrong woman, miss the wrong man. All the stories they tell will be tales of their own invention. Your story was this. You were happy, then you were sad. You slept, you awakened. Sometimes you ate roasted chestnuts, sometimes persimmons.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you've been listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. My guests tonight were Nathaniel Tarn, who read from his latest book, Ins and Outs of the Forest River, and Jane Hirschfield, who gave a reading from her home in Northern California. I hope you enjoyed tonight's program. If you have any questions or comments, please do contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. We started tonight's program with a little French music, so let's go out the same way. Here's Carla Bruni. Thanks for listening.
On me dit que nos vies ne valent pas grand-chose, elles passent en un instant comme fanent les roses. On me dit que le temps qui glisse est un salaud, que de nos chagrins il s'en fait des manteaux. Pourtant quelqu'un m'a dit que tu m'aimes encore. C'est quelqu'un qui m'a dit que tu m'aimes encore. Serait-ce possible alors? On dit que le destin se moque bien de nous, qu'il ne nous donne rien et qu'il nous promet tout. Paraît que le bonheur est à portée de main, alors on tend la main et on se retrouve fou. Pourtant quelqu'un m'a dit que tu m'aimes encore. C'est quelqu'un qui m'a dit que tu m'aimes encore. Serait-ce possible alors? Serait-ce possible alors? Mais qui est-ce qui m'a dit que toujours tu m'aimais? Je ne me souviens plus, c'était tard dans la nuit. J'entends encore la voix, mais je ne vois plus les traits. Il vous aime, c'est secret, lui dites pas que je vous l'ai dit. Tu vois, quelqu'un m'a dit que tu m'aimais encore. Mais l'a-t-on vraiment dit que tu m'aimais encore? Serait-ce possible alors? Pas grand chose, elle passe en un instant comme fanent les roses. On me dit que le temps qui glisse est un salaud, que de nos tristesses il s'en fait des manteaux. Pourtant quelqu'un m'a dit que tu m'aimes encore. C'est quelqu'un qui m'a dit que tu m'aimes encore. Serait-ce possible alors?